and welcome to the Innovation Forum podcast for Friday 3rd of April with me, Ian Welsh. I hope you and yours are all well. Having had a brush with what appears to have been COVID-19 myself this past week, I can highly recommend staying away from it if you can. However, a few days ago, I was able to catch up virtually with Phil Bloomer, Executive Director of the Business and Human Rights Resource Centre. We talked about some of the coronavirus-related human rights and modern slavery risks that are concerning him, and what companies should be keeping an eye on in these strange times. No news roundup this week, I'm afraid. It will return next week and include some analysis of the impacts on sustainable business from the pandemic crisis. The Innovation Forum Spring Conference season continues next month. As I've been talking about for the past couple of weeks, we have been working with developers to create an interactive and engaging online conference experience. This will not only deliver the content from plenary sessions and breakouts, but also provide some exciting opportunities for the networking and conversations on the side of the main event that are so much part of the conference experience. We'll deliver increased networking time, as well as dedicated time slots to host group or one-to-one meetings and discussion with relevant stakeholders. We're very much aware of the differences and constraints involved in online working, and we'll reflect these in how the events are presented. For example, our Sustainable Apparel and Textiles event later this month will now be held over 3 days rather than two to enable effective and engaging content delivery while allowing plenty of breaks. So on the 27th, 28th and 29th of April, we'll be meeting to discuss sustainable apparel and textiles. And among the experts joining us will be representatives of Primark, H&M, Tommy Hilfiger, CNA and Eileen Fisher. Sign up for this event before closing Friday the 3rd and save €100 on conference passes. We're refining the other upcoming conferences, including the Ethical Trade and Human Rights event in early May, and our meetings debating the future of food a few weeks later. The best place to keep up with the details, including revised price of tickets for the online events, are the relevant event pages at www.innovationforum.co.uk. Earlier this week, I spoke with Phil Bloomer, Executive Director of the Business and Human Rights Resource Centre, about some of the impacts of the coronavirus pandemic, something that Phil and his colleagues have been closely monitoring, and the risks of retrenchment on the huge amounts of progress that have been made in the past few years. What are the impacts of the coronavirus going to be on human rights risks that you're seeing?
Yes, thanks, Ian. I mean, the first thing to say is obviously this pandemic does not discriminate in its impact. For businesses, this is an extraordinarily difficult time. For the workers in those businesses and the communities affected by those businesses, it's equally hard. The question is, how is the burden going to be shared or shifted? Is the burden of this pandemic going to be singularly pushed down supply chains to the poorest and most vulnerable people, as many costs tend to be? Or are they going to be shared throughout, both between countries and between the businesses themselves and the workers? And that will define, in many ways, what is the scale of human rights issues that arise from the pandemic itself. If we look at the global economic crisis of 2008 and its aftermath, you can see there that there was a lot of criticism of the way global markets functioned, in the sense that all the benefits of global markets appeared to have been privatized, and then all the costs of the crisis were socialized. I don't think we're seeing that now, or we're seeing some of that, but not to the same degree. I think we're seeing states stepping up, and stepping up in ways that were unimaginable only a few weeks ago. Denmark's stated that it'll pay 75% of the wages of workers that are furloughed or laid off. UK, it's 80%. The German government has made radical shifts away from its black zero of essentially balanced budgets for the state. The US is providing substantial, or promising, massive federal assistance to many manufacturers, services and things like airlines. So all that's coming through. The way that, again, those bailouts to the companies will be managed is going to be fundamentally important to human rights. It's interesting to see Elizabeth Warren recently come out saying we can't have no strings attached bailouts, that there have to be minimum conditions, such as workers' payroll will be maintained, that there'll be a $15 minimum wage. She says a permanent ban on share buybacks, no dividends while companies receiving relief, and collective bargaining agreements to protect workers' rights should remain. So those are some of the initial impacts that are coming from governments. But what, of course, we're recording in all the analysis that we're doing and the big data that we're gathering from around the world is much more about what's happening inside the companies and the way companies are responded.
Let's talk about some of the impacts on specific workers. The gig workers are going to be significantly affected by this. People on 0-hour contracts can be significantly affected. So what are you seeing as the major impacts for those sort of workers?
Gig workers are fundamentally affected, and it then depends on what other social protection measures that governments are bringing in for those workers. A lot of those workers face destitution in countries where there's not going to be that scale of social protection. And we mustn't forget that gig working is not exclusive to Western Europe and North America. It's actually something that is prevalent throughout many emerging economies. So there is a real risk around there. I think the other place we're seeing major issues in the supply chains, and particularly with supply chain workers who are disproportionately affected. If you just look at garments now, looking at Asia and Southeast Asia in particular, we're seeing millions of workers being fired or suspended with their work cancelled, and the brands really cancelling their orders at very short notice, refusing to pay for orders. There's been a massive raw materials shortage from China, though that may start to slacken soon and already is. But we're seeing now, of course, stores closing across Europe and North America, and therefore brands are scrambling to try and delay so that orders don't get on ships, so they don't have to pay. We've just seen the Bangladesh Garment Manufacturers Association saying that they've had to shut down half of the factories because of lost orders and the lack of payments that have been coming through. That has immediate impacts for workers in those supply chains. H&M, for instance, stands out in the sense that it says it will uphold the contracts and will stand by the payment terms of those contracts. But we're hearing from other companies like ASOS and Primark that they're already delaying payments from sort of 90 days to 180 days. It's highly likely that workers won't get paid. And others are even refusing to pay for the raw materials that have already been purchased by the manufacturers, etc. So while we have a major crisis in Western Europe and North America, those kind of practices are delivering a far greater crisis in places like Bangladesh, India, Myanmar, Indonesia. If you look at the free trade zones where much of this manufacturing goes on, we're seeing hundreds of thousands of workers being laid off in those conditions. Often those conditions are far worse because those workers may be working in effectively labour camps in compounds. They're often in squalid, very concentrated conditions, and therefore the workers are dreadfully scared of the virus itself. But they're equally scared as they get laid off that they will not be able to get food on the table for their children, and that there's hunger already being reported in many places because of the lack of payment. I'd come to another example that seems to be strong at the moment, which is the rubber gloves piece. Obviously, the rubber glove manufacturers, the workers in those factories, in a sense, are frontline health workers in the sense that they're creating the very gloves that we all now depend on in this pandemic, because the doctors and nurses that serve our communities depend on them. And of course, those rubber gloves from Malaysia, it's renowned in terms of the scale of bonded labour, migrant workers being brought in, often paying $1,000 for the job, recruitment fees leading to debt bondage. And we're getting reports already from excessive hours, 12-hour days for 30 days without rest, passport retention. WRP and Top Glove have been some of the most important ones. The US has just lifted its ban on the factories of WRP to allow the gloves from that factory to come in. It had been banned because there was so much fear that there was forced labour in their factories. And the NHS is importing 88 million pairs of gloves from Malaysia at this time. So it's important that they're sending messages into those conditions.
There must be a chance that there's a chink of light here, because a lot of the media in the UK have been covering the story that the gloves are coming in from Malaysia from factories that have significant question marks. And when people see that it's suddenly an essential service, there is a kind of a lot of publicity around that and a lot of concern that of these things are going on. So perhaps this is an opportunity for these issues to come to the fore and for public awareness to rise around these things that have been going on in the past without really any public recognition.
No, I think that's right. And I think there's an extraordinary opportunity to humanize the people at the end of the supply chains that deliver so many of the goods and services that we rely on. And the example of rubber gloves, as you say, is a particularly useful one.
It's a difficult time for business. So what are the dangers of not keeping on top of human rights and modern slavery issues right now?
I think everybody understands that business has to make some very hard decisions. you will see that some businesses are really appreciating the importance of essentially sustaining their commitment to human rights and sustaining their commitment to their workers and the communities around them. So, for instance, Unilever has a 500 million euro relief program to shield its workforce from any sudden drop in pay, and supporting the more vulnerable small and medium-sized suppliers that they've got with cash and credits, for instance. Patagonia, again, has closed all its operations, its stores and its orders through its website, but has committed to continue to pay its employees. You can see that there are companies that understand that simply passing all the burden down, in the end, there is a substantial danger that it will come back to bite them. And I think the sustaining of essential human rights standards will be remembered by both manufacturers and by workers over this next period, as well as by governments when it comes to the relationships that companies rely on in terms of their global supply chains. But I think there is a wider piece here, Ian, which is one of the greatest harms of the global economic crisis was the loss of public trust in global markets. Companies should think very hard, and investors should think very hard about what is going to happen in the medium term about that trust in global markets, which is already at a nadir. If it is seen that the largest and richest companies in the world act in ways which are simply ruthless and indeed reckless in terms of the treatment of their workers and supply chains. Equally, if they do right by those, people will understand far better that there is an opportunity for business and markets to deliver shared prosperity and shared security together. That is one of the biggest areas, but there are immediate human rights impacts on workers themselves. Behaving responsibly in the way brands treat their suppliers and insist that the workers in those suppliers are treated is going to be fundamentally important to the long-term health of their supply chains.
There must be a danger that there's going to be regression of all the progress that's been made. Now, there's still a lot to do, obviously, but there has been some progress around business and human rights and modern slavery. Are you worried that we're going to see regression now and that all the hard-fought progresses get lost?
There's always that worry. I'm always an optimist. The extraordinary progress that has been made has demonstrated its worth. And I can't believe for a moment that the businesses that have really started to embrace the elimination of modern slavery, for instance, that understand the value to the business of the empowerment of workers in their supply chains, I can't believe that that's simply going to disappear. But we have to appreciate that poor workers and communities are at the greatest risk, that many of the survivors from those communities will be exposed to extraordinary risk and then appalling choices as they're lured by traffickers into forced labour and bonded labour, and indeed girls are trafficked into sex work. So there is that real risk now, and the way in which the opportunities are created for those survivors from poor communities is going to be substantially important. I think the other thing we are worried about is the increasing sense that this crisis, this pandemic, may lead to rapid automation in a whole set of fields which have been very important to low-paid workers and unskilled workers. EY has just issued this report, I think it was a week or two ago, about 40% of employers from 45 countries say that they're going to speed up automation as soon as the pandemic is over in order to stabilize their own supply chains. And we're seeing that happening. And of course, women in those supply chains are going to be probably the most vulnerable. Some of that, I think, is another major area of concern. I do believe that the advances that have been made, the vast majority of them will not be lost. The problem is that there will be so many vulnerable people after this pandemic that the danger is people see a shortcut to maximizing their return on investment by accepting risks and not doing their due diligence of their supply chain properly.
Automation will be of a particular concern for the Bangladeshi garment sector, no doubt as well. There's also, at the same time as all the problems we've been seeing, there's a rapidly growing funding crisis for NGOs and the charity sector. How much are you seeing that affecting yourselves? And also, how do you think this might pan out as we go forward?
Civil society is a very diverse body, just like companies and like governments. Civil society includes everything from the National Rifle Association to Oxfam. There will be very different impacts in very different areas. And of course, those that are actually providing frontline services can expect to see massive interest from governments to find them helping because it's often those civil society organizations working directly with communities that are the cheapest and most effective and often the most innovative methods by which funders and governments can reach the poor and have an impact on those that are most vulnerable. Equally, for many other civil society organizations who depend heavily on public subscription and public donations, it will be very difficult. People like Oxfam and Amnesty and all those. What happens in these conditions are inevitably that a proportion of their supporters will start to worry about the standing orders that they've got for those organisations. That's a concern. I mean, when I was at Oxfam, we were always amazed at how resilient people were in terms of upholding their standing orders, even in these crises. But, you know, things are very difficult at the moment. So there will be difficult choices that they're making in their domestic finance. And then finally, you've got organisations like the Resource Centre that rely heavily on both foundation funding and government funding. The foundation funding, we think, is going to hold up. Our worry is that many of the governments that support international justice work, such as the work of the Business and Human Rights Resource Centre, may well start to focus much more heavily their funding on the domestic relief and domestic response at the expense of the international work. That is a worry.
Well, thanks for that, Phil, and I hope that the work of the Resource Centre continues for as long as it's required. Once we get through the immediate pandemic crisis, what are the areas of concern for you as business recovers, and what do you want to see happen more positively?
I do think that the way governments have responded this time has learnt a lot from the crisis of 2008. The bailouts and the social protection that's been put in place has been done at a pace that's probably 4 to 8 times the speed at which governments reacted in 2008. And I think, therefore, the hope has to be that although they will incur very significant debts, it will actually be able to sustain a level of effective livelihoods for people in many parts of the world. In that sense, I'm relatively optimistic for the future. Nobody knows how long this is going to go on, but markets seem to be thinking it'll be between 4 and 6 months. And then I do believe that things will be able to slowly return to normal. There will be an increased interest in business and human rights, particularly around the issues of due diligence in business. I think business will be looking at their human rights due diligence, especially in terms of their stability, in terms of human rights due diligence contributing to their stability. And I think investors will be looking very heavily at not just the environmental and governance side of their analysis engagement with companies, but also with the S of ESG, with the social. And therefore, they'll be also looking at these human rights risks that are in the business models of today and demanding significant change. The momentum that was really present, particularly in 2019, where we saw even the likes of Larry Fink and the US Business Roundtable speaking out to say we have to now make business work for all stakeholders and not just shareholders, that is only going to be strengthened by this pandemic and the crisis and the effective response that there has been. I think we have to recognize far more that this is one planet, and business, if it wants to enjoy the benefits of global markets, are really going to have to help much more in making those global markets work for everyone and also for the environmental sustainability that's necessary for this planet.
It's really clear that the climate crisis is one that will have to be addressed in a similar fashion, but perhaps the silver lining of the pandemic is going to be that there is a much greater acceptance of the role of society, both locally, nationally, and globally. And perhaps that'll be how the business and human rights agenda can best be taken forward.
Well, I was a little tickled, I must admit, to hear Boris Johnson saying from his COVID-19 sickbed that he now believes in society. I think that's really welcome because it's so important. You know, there'll be nationalisation of businesses. There'll be then, you know, the reprivatisation or partial reprivatisation of those businesses. The health services are now understood to be so fundamentally important to provide stability. All these things are crowding in and changing the discourse. And for those of your listeners who live in the UK, it does feel now like the government's own trajectory will change substantially, just as it's changing in Germany, and it will be forced to change in places like India. And I think what we're seeing right now, and your listeners will be seeing on the telly regarding the day labourers of India, they will learn lessons from their treatment by the Modi government and by their employers in that country and the supply chains that they've served.
certainly it's a time of extraordinary change. Phil, it's been great to talk as ever. But for now, my thanks to Phil Boomer, Executive Director at the Business and Human Rights Resource Centre.
Thank you very much, Ian.
As always, there is plenty of other content available online at innovationforum.co.uk, with plenty of analysis, podcasts and other interviews. But that's all for now. Best wishes to all of you from all of us at Innovation Forum. I've been Ian Welsh, and I'll be back with you next week.